You know, like you heard that on the news, but like I.
Lost again around 25th. No one saw me go.
Okay, this is KDVS 90.3. Good morning. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am Safikar. I hope I'm coming through. Okay. In this show, like the last one, okay, can you hear me now? All right. This is KDVS 90.3 FM. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am Safikar. In this show, like last week, I am reviewing and discussing a book called A Philosophy of Loneliness, published in 2015 by Lars Svensson, who is a professor of philosophy at Bergen University in Norway. Okay. Now, before I start this week's the remaining chapters of the book, I want to go back and give a short review of last week's show so that you can keep up with it if you haven't been around. All right? So, loneliness has become a widespread problem globally. About 33% of adults experience feeling of loneliness worldwide, sometimes during their lives. In A Philosophy of Loneliness, Svensson tries to answer the question, what is loneliness, why it occurs, who is affected by it, and what can we do about it? The book is largely about human relationship and emotional and mental health. Svensson, in the first chapter, defines loneliness as unfulfilled longing for a close connection. Loneliness indicates that our need for connection is not satisfied. Okay. Svensson notes that some lonely people have many social connections. Some even have partners or are married and have kids and pets. However, they still have an unfulfilled longing, as if their social interactions do not satisfy their desires for connection. So loneliness does not imply a lack of community, but rather an unfulfilled idea of a community. It is a feeling of a discomfort that informs us that our need for relationship is not met. Loneliness also implies a wish to overcome the physical and mental distance between yourself and someone you care about. Lars makes a couple of important points which pertain to how to reduce and deal with loneliness. They're about metaphysical and epistemological loneliness. The first is that being alone in some sense is part of life. It is part of our experience of life. We are fundamentally alone on our life journey. It is true, even when we have very close connection, we still remain fundamentally alone with our own unique experiences and past. For instance, when we go to a concert, we're all singing along with the same song. This, of course, creates a feeling of closeness. But our experiences, thoughts, feelings, as we do this, are unique to each of us. Our experiences always will have a private component that cannot fully be shared with others. In other words, we are like the trees in the forest. We are together, but each of us stands utterly alone. It is important to realize that we all need human connections, but this need cannot be met at every moment of a person's life. Understanding our aloneness this way can help to moderate our expectations and inner standards. Loneliness not only affects our connection with others, it also detaches us from ourselves. A large part of our identity is shaped by our connection and relationship with others. However, a very important part of it is shaped by our inner dialogue and our inner relationship with ourselves. The person who's overtaken by loneliness often blames themselves for their predicament. The lonely often view themselves as being in some way inferior and socially incompetent. They tell themselves, maybe I am the problem. Maybe I'm not lovable. Maybe I'm completely irrelevant to everyone else. Their inner dialogue is very negative. Up to half of our waking hours, we are talking to ourselves, and there's almost a constant inner dialogue in our head. For those who are unhappy, often this voice is very loud, angry, and unkind. Lars argues that loneliness is an emotion. It has both an affective and a cognitive side. Emotions tell us something about reality. This information can be correct or erroneous. Lonely persons don't trust others because they're afraid of being hurt and rejected. They interpret their social surrounding to be threatening to a great extent than non-lonely people. A generalized mistrust of other people is one of the main indicators of loneliness. Svensson argues that while we cannot change an emotion or a mood by an act of will or simply choose an emotion, we can control our moods and affect our emotions in a more direct manner. We have a limited but nonetheless real ability to invite an emotion or to suppress it. The solution to loneliness must be found in the work that the lonely people undertake with themselves. Okay. The cause of loneliness must be sought in a person's inner emotional and cognitive disposition or in the development of them. Our chances of loneliness can increase substantially if during childhood we have lost a parent or a sibling, or if we were left alone by our parents for a long period of time. Most research in loneliness also shows that there's consistently higher loneliness prevalence among men than among women. Lars writes, there are also, he notes that the lonely people tend to be conformists. They lack a viable inner world. He writes, they're also more self-centered than others, and yet self-absorbed individuals are utterly dependent on the gaze of others. It is only by occupying another person's field of view that they find confirmation of their existence. As such, other people become nothing more than a set of mirrors. They'll only believe that they're denied recognition, and they reduce others first and foremost to the role of provider of such confirmation. Ultimately, they're actually not interested in others. That's why they're lonely. Because they're very concerned about how others perceive them, they're often not entirely present in social situation and are overthinking it. They hunt for signs of rejection in others, and because of overinterpretation, they find these and react quickly and strongly. As a result, they feel the social spill. So loneliness becomes a safe option, even though it's very painful. That is a summary of some of the ideas that were discussed last week. Now I will continue with the remainder of the book. In chapter 4, called Loneliness and Trust, Svensson writes, studies have demonstrated a clear inverse correlation between loneliness and generalized trust. The more trusting you are, the less lonely. The less trusting you are, the more lonely. The lonely perceive others as being unreliable and unsupportive. Trust is not easy because it's easy to break down and difficult to build up. Lack of trust produces a caution that undermines the immediacy that is so important in our attachment to others. When we lack trust, we assume that our exposure and vulnerability will be exploited. The fear hinders the precise thing that could cause it to decrease, human contact. But mistrust makes being together more difficult and therefore isolates us from situations where we could learn to trust others. By shutting others out, you also shut yourself inside, and loneliness will most likely accompany you there. The next chapter is one of the best chapters of the book. It's about loneliness, friendship, and love. What can we reasonably expect from friendship and love with regard to loneliness? What are the possibilities and the limits? Svensson claims that what makes love and friendship unique and special is that it can expand the self and provide a glimpse of the self from outside, and thereby providing a validation that one could never get from oneself. Until 1800s, friendship was commonly regarded as the closest personal connection a person could have. But thereafter, marriage assumed that role. For Aristotle, friendship was the greatest of the external goods. He describes three forms of friendships: friendship of utility, of pleasure, and of virtue. He allows the friendship of virtue as the only true friendship. This is a friendship between two good people who actively want to make themselves and each other better persons. I've been married for 37 years. In my first year at UCD, I moved in with the woman that I eventually married. In that year, we were both so hungry for learning and knowledge that every day we would take notes in our classes and present the same lecture to each other later that night. This only lasted for 1 year, but we've had a non-bourgeoisie marriage and no middle-class aspirations, and learning and growing together has always been integral. We're also best friends, and we were friends before becoming close. For Kant, the most valuable friendship is one in which two persons share thoughts, feelings, and secrets with each other. On page 76, Lars writes, a person requires a close confidant with whom he or she can converse without fearing betrayal. Therefore, trust is a central phenomenon in this friendship. Open-heartedness, moreover, is the friendship's existential basis. Friends must be open to each other's thoughts, feelings, and remain sympathetic to each other. For Kant, this form of relationship is the answer to the loneliness that comes from our unsocial sociability. Kant points out that we need to mean something to others to show that we have a value and to enjoy recognition. On page 78, Svensson writes, "When it comes to friendship, a certain amount of unselfishness must be involved. A true friendship or love demands that you, in Aristotle's words, desire to do what is good for others with respect to the other and not yourself." The section on love begins with Aristophanes' story about love as it's presented in Plato's Symposium. In this story, we're originally androgynous beings with two faces, four arms, and four legs. But Zeus cut us in half, producing man and woman. Aristophanes suggests that we could only be happy and complete if we find our other half. In this view, we are incomplete and lonely until we find this person. And if and when we find him or her, all our problems, deficiencies will vanish like dew before the sun. They will fulfill your every need and give your life the meaning it lacks. But this picture is very problematic. It is not realistic, and it imposes a great burden on the beloved and on the whole relationship. When we enter a relationship with our problems and issues, they will be there afterwards. We are separate, and we will remain separate. So we have to give each other plenty of space to be who we are, rather than seeking a perfect harmony in everything. In other words, there is really no such a thing as the magical other. We're all imperfect. We need to find somebody that has some qualities we value, and then work it out and create a deeper relationship. There is no other way. It is responsibility of each and every one of us to sort ourselves out and figure out what is happening to us and why. On page 82, Svensson writes, "It cannot be another person's responsibility to ensure that your life has the prerequisite meaning. Another essential problem with this idea is that it, in fact, places love beyond reach, because you will never succeed in finding a person with whom you are in total harmony. Aristophanes' conception of love precludes actual love in your life. The idea that two people can enter a seamless unity makes love impossible. It is, of course, the embodiment of romantic love. However, Svensson argues that almost all the various stories about love, whether in the movies and novels, are in some sense false and lead us astray. Why? They're all about the beginning of love, not lifelong love. Love unfolds over a longer period of time, during which our perception of the other person takes on an entirely different complexity. The great passions, excitement, and really intoxication, which are there at the start when we fall in love, will only last a few months. In a sense, a real relationship only begins then, and it's largely about learning to get along with each other and resolving disagreement and differences in a peaceful fashion. Here, a new love grows that is different from the first falling in love. In order for love to exist, a new foundation must be built over time. The Korean culture, for instance, acknowledges this, and in Korean language, there are two distinct words for these two loves. The intoxicating love at the beginning is called sarang, and the love that appears after intoxication has subsided is called chung-ui. Now, the idea that there are two distinct stages to love, as you may know, also has a lot of scientific backing. Helen Fisher of Rutgers has shown this by looking at the changes that occur in the brain activities of newlyweds by fMRI scanning over a long period of time. All relationships have difficulties, but the question is, are these difficulties to be seen as signs that love is past? Or by working them out, are they a basis for further deepening of love? Friendship and love can help us overcome loneliness. But Svensson cautions that we must keep in mind they cannot be perfectly realized. The lonely put such impossible demands on friendship and love that they make it impossible for themselves to befriend and love others, and therefore guarantee their loneliness. In page 90, Lars writes, ultimately, there is only one answer to the question of why I should be friends with X and in love relationship with Y, and that is that X and Y make me a better version of myself than I would otherwise be. This is hearkening back to Aristotle's conception of friendship. On page 92, Svensson writes, it is, in Rilke's words, possible to attain a love which consists in the mutual guarding, bordering, and saluting of two solitudes. Okay, the next chapter is called Individualism and Loneliness. That's chapter 6. This is the weakest chapter of the book. In this chapter, Lars defends liberal democracy against the charges that it makes individuals, quote, lonely, hedonist, and egotist, or that it produces, in quote, tortured souls hunted by alienation, anxiety, and depression. He does this by presenting research that shows loneliness is more prominent in collective and authoritarian countries. He also argues that social media is making us less lonely, but laments that it's making solitude scarcer. I am not certain if Svensson is working or living in a red-baiting environment, but in this chapter he seems anxious and determined not to be critical of liberal capitalist democracy. Many people who write about psychological problems or depression, they take time to be critical of certain aspects of capitalism, but they're not even often political or revolutionary, so it's possible to be critical of the system without wanting radical change. Chapter 7 is called Solitude. Svensson argues that you must seek solitude because it adds value to your life. It is an indefinite openness to a variety of experiences, thoughts, and emotions. Solitude creates freedom and independence, peace in which to work, and a good character, and it uplifts the soul. Social space is for diversion, but solitude connects us with deeper truths. Solitude provides freedom from others' demands and enables us to reflect on our life, values, and beliefs and truly know ourselves. The path to self-knowledge must pass through solitude. Only in solitude you can become who you are. Solitude forces us to relate to ourselves and to find peace within this self-relationship. But solitude will not come to us. It always requires self-effort. In solitude, we achieve a more direct relationship to ourselves because it is not mediated by the gaze of others. Being a mature person, in a sense, means being able to stand alone with our convictions without leaning on others for support, and we cannot do this without solitude. The nemesis of solitude is distraction, the bustle. Those who are not at peace with themselves always seek distraction. Distraction literally means being drawn apart. What we're drawn apart from is ourselves. In loneliness, one is alone with oneself, whereas in solitude, one is together with oneself. Excuse me. The point here is, again, that we need to invest in a rich inner life in our youth so that we can avert loneliness and depression in midlife and old age. Midlife crisis happens to those people who have taken their life's leads from others and have not bothered to find out who they are, what are their particular skills and strengths, and what kind of lives best fits these. They usually end up with jobs that pay well, but do not satisfy their soul or hone in their creativity and personality. So they become burned out and unhappy. Sometimes, unfortunately, years from now, the parent or the parents, for whose sake and love we become lawyers, doctors, or whatever, become the statue of our unrealized dreams and potentials. Chapter 8, Loneliness and Responsibility. Svensson argues that we're responsible for our emotions because we have chosen the behavioral patterns that strengthen and maintain these emotions. Those plagued by loneliness might make themselves aware of the various dynamics of loneliness and what is happening to them, and to become more realistic about their expectations in social situations. This is the task no one else can do for them. The lonely must try to change the way they think about social situations. At the end of the book, Lars raises a worry. The problem is that for the lonely, loneliness is experienced as being imposed from outside, as resulting from an unsatisfactory social environment that does not live up to one's expectations. The complaints of the lonely are the complaints of the pain caused by a basic human need going unfulfilled. 6 out of 10 happy people who are surveyed identify their intimate relationships with another as the main reason for their happiness, therefore suggesting that the lonely need to change their relationship with themselves and their environment can seem like blaming the victim. The author argues that personal experiences may not be sufficient to understand the role of loneliness in human existence. Lars grants that loneliness is experienced as being externally imposed because one's environment is inadequate to meet one's emotional need for attachment. But he argues that if we pay close attention to what is happening to us and how we're responding, we may also perhaps realize that we possess some character traits that help to shape that perception, such as our expectation for actual attachment being too great, or that we are not sufficiently trusting, that we are too self-absorbed, or we are too critical of ourselves and others in social situations. The fact that you're lonely does not necessarily mean that others have failed you or that they have fallen short. It can be that it is you who have fallen short in your evaluation of the attachments you actually have to others. All right. So that was it. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the show. I will get back to you next week. And see, I'm now trying to play a song, but I've lost it. Let's see. Okay, I think I found it. There we go.
You feel real hurt. Come on over to the place where I was, and all your loneliness I'll try to soothe. I'll play the blues. Come on in. You might run across, yeah, some of your old friends. All your loneliness I've got to soothe. I'll play the blues for you. Come on in. Sit right here. Let's rap a while. You see, I'm kind of lonely too, you know. And loneliness is a very bad thing if you let it get the best of you. And loneliness can get you down, you know. Yeah, yeah. Are you comfortable now? Yeah. as I was saying before, loneliness can get you down. And I have heard of loneliness blowing some good people's mind, you know? But you can't do that. This is a big world. This is a big world. There's too many nice things happening in this world. You're a very pretty girl. Where you live? No, no, no. Disregard that. That's okay. That's the most important thing. I want to know you. I say, I want to know you. Ooh-wee, that's groovy, ain't it? I'll play the blues for you. I ain't got no big name. Oh, Lord, and I ain't no big star. I'll play the blues for you on my guitar. Oh, your loneliness, I'll try to soothe. I'll play the blues for you. Excuse me.
Está escuchando 90.3 KDVS, Davis.
Do you care about the environment? Are you interested in getting involved? Well, then check out the Campus Center for the Environment website, cce.ucdavis.edu.
Hola, buenos días. Yo soy DJ Aura y estás escuchando a La Tiendita en KDVS 90.3. Si no hablas español, my name is DJ Aura. This is La Tiendita on KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. This is an international and Latin show where I play music from Latin America. Este show yo toco música de Latinoamérica, canciones en español, pero también yo tengo canciones de portugués para los brasileños allá. Pero hoy vamos a empezar con merengue con Juan Luis Guerra, con su canción El Primero en su álbum Ni Es Lo Mismo Ni Es Igual. Ok, bye bye.
Vamos a ver, tengo un primo, baila mino y no sé cómo calificarlo.